Welcome to this podcast. Calliope Awards for 2010 were presented on Thursday, April 29th. Calliope is the student journal of art and literature published every spring at Northern Virginia Community College, Annandale campus. Now you will hear winners in the category of fiction as they read from their works. Second prize, Natalie Patel, The Fields.
I sit in my father's truck in the 2 o'clock sun in front of our house. Again, I shift my legs on the vinyl seat as it re-glues to my thighs with sweat. My fingers roll around the edges of a hole in the door where a handle should be. The glass perched on my father's lips empties for a third time, and he hands it to me and asks for another. I take it and reach through the passenger window to open the door from the outside. The screen door slaps silently against the frame going into the house. The kitchen is quiet, too, in my mother's absence, almost as if her week of being bedridden has caused the house to fall into hibernation in the middle of summer, and nothing moves. I turn the faucet on and fill the glass with water. Through the kitchen window, I see my father, with one sunburnt arm propped atop the door, just staring. I lean with my tiptoes over the sink and look out into the fields of wheat. I don't know what has caught his eye exactly, but the way the grass flows is mesmerizing. He told me once that my mother danced like wheat on a windy day, and that's all I could think about 3 summers ago when I was 11 and the wheat had caught fire and burnt like matchsticks. I had closed my eyes, felt the burn of smoke in my throat, and imagined my mother's dress singeing her legs as she twirled within the flames.
First prize, Joy Noelle Strait, Misfit.
Thank you so much for this award. Surrounded by men, worker men, with their own slang and ringety-dingety twang, that isn't exactly country, but is more than just redneck. The kind of men who don't go by their real names. Maybe their mothers knew that one day their sons would grow up to be worker men and name them accordingly, like Lubby or Bubba or something. You might be guessing that I felt out of place. The answer is yes, and for that fact I thank God. It would be frightful if I did fit in. I'm quite accustomed to not fitting in and have even learned to find enjoyment as a misfit. It feeds my curiosity about those who are different from me. So this job wasn't too much of a discomfort. Being born into a family with 4 boys ahead of me, I was basically born not fitting in. Naturally, as my birth, I have continually and mysteriously fallen into male-dominated circles of life. Regardless, the work had to be done, the summer morning sleep had to be cut chronically short, and the money had to be made to provide for my ultimate and ironic destination to an all-women's college. We called ourselves the Pond Doctors. It was like a child naming her pet turtle, Cheetah. The Pond Doctors were only one of many different segments of the entire corporation. We were responsible for cleaning, repairing, and building ponds. Building was not exactly our specialty. In fact, the first pond I built with my new crew was the first pond ever built under the name Pond Doctors. Others in the corporation worked landscaping, road construction, and all that other hoopty-hoopty, as my boss would say. My boss, everyone called him Smiley, and I never dared question it. It was, in his words, originally from North Kakalaki, and was only working in Virginia because a judge had sent him there for anger management counseling. He had a 10-year-old daughter back in North Carolina that everyone said he spoiled to death when she came to visit. Simply knowing that he had a daughter eased my fear of his potentially precarious character. Smiley was a talker, so I could pretty much write his autobiography, but I would really rather not. Thank you.
Now you will hear winners in the category of creative nonfiction as they read from their works. second prize, Helena L. Perry, Calm in the Midst of the Storm.
As a relatively mild summer was drawing to a close, bathing suits retired to the back of the closet, only to be replaced with the latest fall trends. Stores advertised back to school sales, and children said their last goodbyes to their summer camp friends. One was beginning to grow tired of the coveted barbecue ribs and potato salad that had almost become a daily indulgence, for it was often too hot to cook indoors. Time itself began to shift and daylight began to wax dim much sooner than weeks before. Without warning, dark clouds filled the humid air. To say it began to rain would be an understatement. It began to pour. On the 28th day of August in the year 2005, my life and the lives of countless others would forever be changed. News reporters would call it the storm of the century, Katrina, a Category 5 hurricane, which would encapsulate the entire Gulf Coast and whose fury could be felt for generations to come. Watching the devastation from my television hundreds of miles away, tucked into the safety of a condo in Virginia Beach and listening to the rain as it beat methodically upon my windows, I felt helpless. Never before in my life was I connected to a people whom I'd never met before. It would have been easy to pick up a phone and call in a donation to one of the various organizations that were soliciting assistance. Yet this time, I would give more than money. I would give hope. Thank you.
First prize, Catherine Aisha Rahim, Scar Tissue.
I just want to ask everyone to bear with me because I had a hard time cutting anything out of my story, but I hope you'll enjoy it anyway. The 9mm tucked discreetly in his jacket pocket was small, efficient, and loaded, with six bullets waiting impatiently for their target, two apiece, just in case. He rang the doorbell, flashed a smile at the woman who answered, and invited him in. Less than 15 minutes later, he was on his way to the door. The home was silent, but for the dull sound of three metal bullet casings hitting each other as he dropped them into his pocket. Whistling softly, he left the way he came in. I've always wondered what God tastes like. As a child, I attended a Catholic school, which meant going to Mass every Friday for 4 years. I liked it. I liked the ceremony of it, liked its comforting predictability. I liked the procession as white-robed altar boys flanked the solemn-faced priest as they walked to the altar. I liked the priest's steady voice as he asked God to forgive our sins. I liked saying the familiar prayers aloud with the rest of the congregation. I liked the trappings, the rosaries, the delicate Bibles, the stained glass saints casting colors on the floor. And I liked the sensations, the heady scent of incense, the sounds of rustling pages as parishioners slipped through hymnals, the feeling of the wooden banisters rubbed smooth by countless hands trailing over them, the sight of the rafters at meeting at a sharp angle above the altar, the beams pointing to the heavens. But I never got to taste. In a school of 600 students, I was one of two non-Catholic people, and the other person was my brother. After my classmates had their first communion, I stayed behind, watching them file past me every Friday. I sat alone, breathed the incense-laden air, listened to the priest bless each individual, ran my fingers over the pew in front of me, looked up at the peaked roof leading to God's front door, and I wondered. I haven't seen the inside of that chapel since I left the school in fourth grade. Religion became something I thought about only at bedtime when I whispered my nightly prayer, please bless Mommy and Daddy and Hassan and Emily and everyone else. She was still in me, the little girl who'd once written in her journal, I love God and Jesus and especially Mary. I still believed. When the news broke, I was almost 12, tucked in bed when the phone rang at 11:09. Late night calls were forbidden, and, my curiosity sparked, I went upstairs to investigate. My family was in the kitchen, the phone pressed to my brother's ear. Six eyes were glued to the tiny television on the counter. I looked at the screen, then at my family's faces, bewildered, wondering why they were fascinated by footage of police tape outside a suburban home. Before I could ask what was going on, my brother's voice cut like a blade into my thoughts. Oh, holy shit. Jesus, it's his house. It's his goddamn house. Face ashen, he dropped the phone. Tears rolled down my mom's cheeks. My dad's eyes were closed tightly, his jaw clenched. My brother's face was frozen in disbelief. His eyes were wet. I went to him, my 16-year-old brother who hadn't cried in years. I slipped my arm through his and took his hand. He didn't look at me, didn't speak, but his hand tightened on mine. And I stood beside him, his hand holding mine like a lifeline, until both his legs and his defenses caved and he slid, broken, to the floor. His name was Nick, and he was 16. He and my brother had a falling out a few months previously, but only days earlier they'd fallen back to friendly acquaintances, if not friends. The last conversation they had concerned a concert that weekend and their vague plans to meet at the show. His parents were friends of mine. When the boys were younger, they played soccer together, coached by my dad. There's still a photo on our wall of the sweaty 10-year-olds beaming after a big win. Nick's smile is mischievous, and despite his youth, you could tell he'd grow up to make girls swoon. And he did. As one of my brother's friends, I was contractually obligated to have a crush on him. The few times he sent a smile my way, my prepubescent heart swelled. We'll never know why, on a pretty summer day, a man walked into Nick's home and walked back out, leaving three bodies behind. Some people would argue that it was all part of God's plan. I think that's complete crap, a lame excuse to justify poverty and natural disasters and the extermination of whole races of people, a lame excuse to justify why God would allow a 16-year-old to be shot point blank in his own home. In the span of seconds, any verbs connected to Nick's name went from present tense to past. In the span of seconds, he went from a living, breathing adolescent to a body, to a memory. And whatever part of me that once believed was ripped out, the wound left to harden to scar tissue. And I don't wonder what God tastes like anymore. Thank you.
The Calliope Committee is grateful to Annandale faculty and staff for their continued and generous support. Office of the Provost, Office of Student Development, Division of Languages and Literature, Division of Liberal Arts, Lyceum Committee, Languages and Literature Events Committee, Media Manager and Staff of the Nova Office of Public Information and Publications, and the faculty and students of the campus creative writing and art courses. Robert Brown of Nova's Web Services and Digital Media served as technical editor. Nova, a great place to teach, a great place to learn. For Calliope, I'm Shirley Noon.